It is so wonderful to step into a community, and it's so wonderful just to step into community, especially in these last few years of so much isolation. And with that too, I also just want to offer my gratitude for people who are intentionally choosing to be on Zoom. That's a real gift of generosity after these past few years to, on purpose, decide to be on Zoom. And my hope, of course, is that it feels like it's worth doing Zoom for your time with me and together as a community today. And yeah, and I certainly hope we do all have a chance to meet together in person as well. But it's just wonderful to be here. It is amazing, in fact, that we can connect with people all over the world in this way on Zoom, despite my little teasing about Zoom. It is a miracle. It's one of those things, actually, about this pandemic that we'll talk about it more when I get into the talk, but there are these, despite this very difficult time that we've been through, that there are these things that can come out of it. Not always, but there can be these amazing things that come out of difficult times. But again, thank you for your presence. And let's begin with a practice for, 25 minutes or so, half hour. And I'll share a few thoughts. And then we'll hopefully have a bit of a discussion and really start to bring all of our wisdom to bear. We can find for ourselves a comfortable posture. And as always, at your comfort level, you can allow your eyes to lower. Close your eyes, even if that feels comfortable for you. Grounding yourself in the moment, perhaps aware of any sounds around you. Sensations in your body, points of contact. Feeling rooted and grounded in the lower half of your body. Sense of uplift in your upper body. Body feeling strong and confident, just sitting like a mountain. Embodying the confidence and strength
of the mountain. Your attention may wander, but you can find some stillness, strength in your body, solid, like the mountain. You're perhaps shifting your focus to your breath, just enjoying the rise and fall. Each inhale and each exhale. The sounds and sensations of each breath. Rising and falling like waves in the ocean, just washing away. Lingering thoughts, concerns. Breath like the waves of the ocean. Just watching them one after the next, after the next. short or long, deep or shallow, just watching the breaths come like waves. You're bringing your awareness now up to your mind, just seeing your mind vast and open, accepting like the sky. Clouds and storms may drift through, but the sky is always there, watching, accepting, open. Mind like the sky. Open, accepting, and perhaps even a bit curious. And shifting your awareness down to your heart. Feeling your heart shining like the sun. the warmth of compassion spreading outward. As well as inward. Warming yourself with compassion as you have enough to radiate outward to the world. Heart shining like the sun. Let's savor with our awareness perhaps three more breaths. Before we begin to bring our awareness outward. You can wiggle your toes a little bit if you need. Tense and release your muscles as you come back to wherever you are on this late January day or morning if you're on Pacific time, evening if you're on Europe time, or wherever you find yourself in the world. And even before you come back to the screen, maybe take a look beyond the screen, out the window if you've got one. In a few moments, noticing what you see or what's new even, that you hadn't noticed before. And then bringing your awareness back once more to the Zoom, where we find ourselves. Well, thank you for sharing that practice with me. It's some imagery that I got really, in the pandemic, I got really into this imagery. I found it really helpful for myself and really grounding. And so thank you. I think imagery can be so powerful in terms of helping us embody, cultivate qualities, especially as we look to nature, which holds so many incredible lessons for us, incredible symbols for us of strength. You know, those of us that have studied MBSR, right? The image of the mountain being a powerful one there, and of course, more ancient traditions besides MBSR as well, or the feeling of the breath like waves, sun, warmth of compassion, and sky, and so forth. And as we close the practice too, I encourage us to look beyond. We do spend a lot of time on Zoom. And it is important actually for our focus. When we spend time on devices, we actually hunch over. Our breath actually changes. This is a real phenomenon called screen apnea. I'm blanking on the name of the woman who coined this phrase, but our breath gets dysregulated. And we know that as our breath gets dysregulated, the rest of us actually gets dysregulated. Our brains get dysregulated and so forth. So taking that time to look beyond. I'm on this little practice actually called 20-20-20. Every 20 minutes, take about 20 seconds to look about 20 feet in the distance, which for those of you not in the US, that's like 6 feet. It doesn't actually, 6 meters. It doesn't actually really matter. The point is just to look away from your screen every so often. But thank you for coming back with me. So the topic today really did start to grow out of a lot of my own personal experiences, before, during, and after. Is it even after, right? This pandemic, and experiences I've had working with folks. My day job is as a therapist, and just reflecting on how, you know, all of these metaphors, I think, in the Dharma tradition, you know, the lotus flower blossoming from the mud, right? And finding strength within ourselves to heal ourselves rather than from outside, whether we call that Buddha nature or, you know, whatever it is that we might call that. But these ways that we actually, for so many of us, we also come to these practices because of suffering. It's rare that people go to a mindfulness class, like, everything in my life is going great, I'm going to add in some mindfulness. Like, it's usually, right, some kind of suffering in ourselves. It's often seeing suffering in someone that we love and feeling helpless to be able to help them through their suffering, whether that's
January 29th, illness. Sunday, Sangha meditation with Christopher Willard. Books are Alpha Breaths, Growing Up Mindful, and How We Grow Through What We Go Through.
I'm hearing a voice. Okay. thank you. You know, we often all do, you know, have some suffering in ourselves or in someone that we often care about. And so we seek out relief through these practices. And these practices, of course, we know are ancient and adapted, wanting to make sure that we acknowledge that. But they really are tremendously healing. And yet at the same time, it's important to recognize what are the ways these can be particularly challenging to sit quietly for 25 minutes, 30 minutes, or even longer, right? Especially when our nervous systems are abuzz or are dysregulated in some way. And so thinking, too, how do we adapt these practices in a way that can be most helpful, most healing for the most people, and learning, too, how to do that for ourselves. And my own story, as far as suffering, you know, I got started with these practices. I was really struggling when I was pretty young, in my early 20s with substance abuse, and had dropped out of college. And my parents basically dragged me on a retreat with Thich Nhat Hanh, which is a pretty amazing way to spend your first week or so sober. and, you know, really kind of swirling with the trauma of those experiences, but finding myself incredibly suddenly grounded and thinking, you know, there's magic in these practices and something healing in these practices, but also the realization that I think Thich Nhat Hanh in particular would emphasize, that there's healing in community. And that as we learn to heal, right, that so often does happen with others. And as I then became a psychologist and started studying this, learning that this is a very real phenomenon. This is called co-regulation, what we do as human beings, right? A parent or caregiver and a child, perhaps, or another important adult in someone's life can help us learn to co-regulate. And then we learn how to regulate ourselves. And mindfulness is very powerful in helping us do this. And these self-compassion practices too are very powerful. And it's been very dysregulating, of course, this time in the pandemic. And that's the other place where the book began in particular, which was right before the pandemic. My mom, who I have been very close with, she was diagnosed with Lewy body dementia, which was very painful. So trying to visit her was really challenging, and a lot of suffering for all of us in our family and challenges. And at the same time, of course, we're all in this tremendous isolation and feeling this. Everybody in the world, talk about common humanity, every single person just about in the world was suddenly stuck in place, sheltering in place with this pandemic that we've been a part of, and experiencing all of those traumatic responses of fear and anger and sorrow and all of these other experiences that we saw in ourselves and we saw in the people that we love, and we certainly saw online also. And following that with a sudden realization around social justice at the societal level for many people, and kind of what came through that as well. But at the beginning of the pandemic, I remember sitting in my backyard with my family and looking out with my wife and our kids. And my wife actually, she's a historian of medicine. So she actually studies how plagues and pandemics alter the course of history. And usually when I say that, people are like, can we have her speak and not you? This is interesting, but we'd love to hear about her. So maybe someday. But we're sitting in the backyard and I'm thinking, you know, trying to sound profound, I'm like, the kids are always going to remember this time. And my wife just says, you know, the everyone's going to, in 1,000 years, people are going to talk about the pandemic of 2020 and the, I guess this, you know, the Delta of 2021 and the Omicron of 2022 and so forth. But, you know, this was helpful to get this larger perspective that everyone was experiencing this in the same way. You know, thinking, you know, what are we going to do for this 2 weeks? We're going to be home for 2 weeks. What are we going to do in this 2 weeks? And looking around and seeing, you know, online, like what other people were doing. And, you know, people like, well, I'm going to, you know, do a marathon on my Peloton, and I'm going to teach myself 5 languages, and thinking, oh my gosh, I'm never going to work again. I'm, you know, I've got 2 kids. How am I going to handle this? And I thought back to Jon Kabat-Zinn's famous quote of, I can't remember exactly how it goes, I'm sure I'll butcher it, but we've gone from human beings to human doings, and thinking maybe this time is actually should be less about what am I going to do and a bit more about what kind of person do I want to be? What kind of father do I want to be to my kids? What kind of son do I want to be to my sick parents? What kind of therapist do I want to be on Zoom? And thinking too about, you know, what kind of neighbor do I want to be? Remembering almost 3 years ago, right? Everyone go to the grocery store and, you know, there's toilet paper shortages, and just thinking like, do I want to be the guy who takes the last roll of toilet paper at the grocery store? Or do I want to be the guy who's checks in with my neighbors or people that are more vulnerable and says, hey, I'm going to the grocery store. What can I get for you? Right. That may be, can be the kind of values that I want to start to cultivate through this challenging time. And I think many of us actually really rose to the occasion and did that. And certainly we can look around and feel like not everybody globally did, but many of us did rise to the occasion to be better neighbors, to be better, challenge ourselves to be the best that we could be. And so this started to then really inform my work too. I do all these workshops about mindfulness, and I do a lot of workshops about mindfulness in kids, or talking to companies about mindfulness and corporations, and everything got canceled. And then the next thing I knew, I was busier than ever being asked to give talks about trauma, 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 and resilience, 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 and wondering, where does mindfulness even fit in all of this? Does it have a place? And starting to discover that, in fact, yes, it does. And as I started doing more research on trauma and resilience and looking historically, looking anthropologically, looking spiritually, and looking at the neuroscience as well, seeing this sort of amazing theme start to come up, that the most likely thing to arise actually after difficult experiences for us humans is not in fact post-traumatic stress. It's actually more likely that we develop what's called post-traumatic growth. And this was really surprising and inspiring to me. And so I started trying to understand more deeply, well, this certainly doesn't happen for everyone. And I also want to be really cautious and not kind of perpetuate some kind of toxic positivity of like, oh, if you're not getting better or you're not getting faster or stronger, right, that there's something wrong with you, because we want to be very cautious about that. But that this is a possibility, a very real possibility. And so if we look at the Dharma doesn't say, okay, you do this and this happens, right? That's not karma, right, so much. It's more, what are the conditions under which this is likely to arise? What are the conditions under which we're likely to experience this kind of growth? And looking at, what does wisdom have to say? What does science have to say? And I'm starting to understand more deeply that there's different aspects of what creates mental health, which is, of course, my day job, and mental illness as well. And we can call this, in clinical terms, we call this the biopsychosocial model, which is basically a fancy way of saying, right, we used to write all these essays when I was growing up, is it nature or is it nurture, right? Biopsychosocial, our bodies, how do we care for our bodies in a way with mindfulness and self-compassion? How do we care for our minds, the psychological, our minds and our emotions? How do we bring more mindfulness? How do we bring more self-compassion to our minds, to our mental experiences, and more clear seeing to our mental experiences? Because we know that under stress and threat, things are often vastly distorted, and distorted long beyond a difficult event. That's what post-traumatic stress is, really. And then lastly, to our relationships, to our social worlds, to not just our immediate relationships socially, but how do we relate to society as a whole, in person or in isolation or online when we were stuck online, and that this can impact our mental health and it can create mental illness, but it can also, the more we care for these with mindfulness and self-compassion, it starts to cultivate that growth, that healing. And so finding these ways then to learn to care more deeply for our bodies, more deeply for our minds, and more deeply for our relationships really then impacts us and ripples out in these truly amazing ways. And so I want to just go over a little bit each of these. We don't have a lot of time, but just share a few examples and practices from caring a bit more for our bodies, caring a bit more for our minds, and cultivating a bit more in our social relationships. But what we know about difficulties and traumas, small and large, is that they do change us. I mean, that goes without saying, right? But they really do change us. People talk about trauma lives in the body. What does that really mean? I always sort of felt like, what exactly does that mean? What it means is that we have our nervous system, which runs throughout our entire body. And our nervous system is there to keep us safe from different threats and dangers. It was wired into us through evolution thousands of years ago. So if we experience something dangerous, right, we actually transform to be on edge for danger all the time, to anticipate it. And we then are unable to perceive safety accurately, and we're actually often then become unable to perceive true danger accurately. And you can see this at the individual level, and you can also look at this at the larger societal level globally. You can certainly see that in the pandemic, right? Just so much distortion and in judgment and decision making and things like this, and perception of what's dangerous and what's not dangerous. What I like to demonstrate sometimes is just if you hold up your hands like this and just start by squeezing your fists really tightly, you might notice how your breath and your body feel as you do this. Bring some mindful awareness to how usually uncomfortable this is, although it can feel a bit empowering in some ways too. But your breath starts to get dysregulated. Your brain might feel a bit more closed off. Closed, and then just to let go, and it can feel nice to let go. Then I feel like you can kind of collapse over like this in your seat. Noticing now how your body feels your breath, noticing how much energy though you have, how clear your thoughts are or not. And then finding a posture a bit more in the middle, just palms up like this, not too tight, not too loose. Seeing breath, body, and mind. And you can put one hand on the other and just rest these over your heart for a moment. Noticing this experience in your body, in your breath, mind, emotions. And if you want to hold your hand like this, if it's nice, you can, or you can set it back down again. But what I'm inviting us to do is explore different ways we respond to life's challenges, whether it's our ancestors running away from the tiger or us in the modern world facing emotional challenges, financial challenges, discrimination, right? So many other things that we might face or that we might fear. What we do essentially is we go into the way we would as if we were being chased by tigers thousands of years ago, right? We have the fight or flight responses like this, great for getting away from the tiger. We have the freeze and faint, freeze and kind of forget it response, like we're trying to hide from the tiger or play dead. And those are really useful for many of the threats that our ancestors faced, and even some threats we still face, is to fight and flee or to freeze and just sort of say forget it, or whatever F word you want to put in there besides forget it. But these aren't so useful when we're faced with many of the things that we face or after the threat has passed. And yet our bodies are still in fight or flight, or our bodies are still in freeze and faint. And usually what happens is we start by going into fight or flight, and then over time this becomes unsustainable, and we go into more of this freeze and faint kind of response. And these are what we see as often those post-traumatic stress kinds of responses, and people's brains have wired into being like this, and their nervous system is wired into being like this when it's no longer helpful to be like that. Because it's not helpful to fight your boss or to flee from your financial obligations or just, you know, freeze and hide and say forget it in the face of whatever other challenges we face. But this is what our bodies are doing to try to keep us safe, what our nervous system is doing to try to keep us safe. And our brain starts to shut down. We start to misperceive things. Some of us know about the negativity bias. We generally perceive things a bit more negatively than positively. We need that for survival. Better assume that's a tiger than it's a fluffy cat, right? Even if it's a fluffy cat 9 times out of 10, it's just a tiger once, it's going to eat me. I don't pass on my genetic material. We're wired to perceive things as worse than they are. We get stressed out. We're in a pandemic. We go through difficult times, whatever those might be. Illness, addiction, someone else's sickness, mental health issues, traumas on the body, right? All kinds of different things, pandemics, right? And we're wired, right, all the time then to see everything as a threat. And so the good news though is that we're also wired with these other ways that our nervous system can respond. We might say we also have seeds of other responses planted in us if we want to take a more karmic kind of spiritual model. And that is that we have what we might call the attend and befriend responses, or the mindfulness and compassion and self-compassion responses that are always in there. It's how do we start to water the seeds of those, Right? The conditions are there. How do we continue to cultivate the conditions under which we can come into more mindfulness and compassion and self-compassion? And that's the work a lot of us have already been doing. That's why we come to these beautiful sanghas in person and online so that we can continue. How can I get more of this feeling in my life, or share a little bit more of this kind of presence with the people that I love and feel a bit more like this more often? And so we can do this in any number of different ways, right? We can practice mindfulness. We can practice self-compassion. We know actually that even just giving ourselves a little gentle touch, like the work of Chris Germer and Kristen Neff, this actually starts to shut down the fight or flight response. And it activates that attend and befriend mindfulness and compassion. It actually shuts off cortisol, the stress hormone, and that activates oxytocin, which is like the love, connection, safety hormone, so we can start to feel safe and connected again. But starting with a few simple ways to care a bit more effectively for our body, because to feel safe in our body is of utmost importance for growth, for healing, to feel like we can be safely embodied, as I heard someone say recently. And so finding movement practices, finding breathing practices, finding eating practices even that we know are healing and helpful to build a strong, healthy body are really a key here. So I often, when we think about mindfulness, we often start with the breath. And I always sort of wondered, like, well, what's the big deal with the breath, right? Breath is so boring. But starting to learn that actually, when we regulate our breath, we actually are learning to regulate our nervous systems, right? We know that we can regulate our breath, that regulates our body, that regulates our nervous system and our brain, which helps us to then regulate our attention, our impulses, and our emotions. And there are two kinds of breathing when we think about the mindfulness. Well, there's way more than two, actually. I'm going to start with two categories of breathing. There's mindful breathing, and there's more of what we call regulated breathing or deliberate breathing. And mindful breathing is really just trying to watch our breath. And that's a place that we all are actually aiming to get to, but that can be sometimes a difficult place to start. It's difficult because it's boring, and it's difficult also because it's not a lot to focus on. So for people that are a bit dysregulated, your mind can kind of wander off a little bit and start to feel a bit triggered sometimes for some folks. When we do what we might think of as more regulated breathing, this actually really resets the nervous system. In fact, that's how I sometimes talk about it, is that we're trying to hit the reset button on the nervous system. Like when your phone stops or the internet stops working, right, you call Comcast, and after you've, you know, 3 hours on hold, you get through to somebody and you're like, oh my gosh, finally, okay, my internet's not working. And they say, restart your computer. And then you restart your computer. And then what happened, right? 90% of the time that works, that fixes it. I used to do IT. 90% of the time you hit the reset button, things work again. Not 100, but 90% of the time that works. The human reset button is in the bottom of our lungs. I was reading in James Nestor's book, probably some people know this already. We have different nerve endings in the top of our lungs and the bottom of our lungs. So if you breathe short and shallow, like when you're like this, you can give yourself a panic attack. I don't recommend it, but you can do that. If you breathe more deeply, the nerve endings in the bottom of your lungs, when the oxygen hits those, it tells your body that you're safe. It tells your body that you can trust other people. It tells your brain to start focusing and thinking in more complex ways. So we breathe more deeply. We hit that reset button in the bottom of our lungs. And we can feel very quickly as we slow the breath down into about 5 or 6 breaths in a minute that actually the nervous system is reset. We start to feel safe. We perceive things not with that extreme negativity bias quite so much anymore, but with a bit more accuracy.
and we feel trusting and we feel good, basically. So just finding these ways to occasionally offer ourselves a reset breath, again, 5 or 6 breaths in a minute, is a really powerful way of managing our nervous system. And it's also what's kind of extraordinary is that many different traditions already do this. Saying the Hail Mary, doing the odd Om Padme Padme Om, doing a number of different indigenous chants, doing a number of different prayers from different spiritual traditions actually shift our breath into about that 5 or 6 breaths in a minute, slightly stronger, slightly longer exhale rhythm, so that we learn to regulate our breath, our body, regulate our nervous system, regulate our brain, begin to re-regulate our emotions and even our interpersonal system more effectively, so that we know who to trust and who not to trust, which is one of the most important things when we've been through difficult experiences. So sometimes I talk about the reset button, sometimes I talk about just stretch your breath. I like this one a lot. Just when you notice, when you're at that stoplight or you're in traffic or you're in your driveway or, you know, about to walk in on your front porch, knowing it might be a challenging interaction when you walk across the threshold of your home or the threshold of your workplace or these challenging places, and you just stretch your breath a little bit, stretch that exhale. That begins to reset the nervous system a little bit. So finding these moments where we can do that can be quite powerful. Other ways we care for our bodies, right? Many of us have experienced in mindful eating practices and done the eating a raisin. I still remember eating a raisin for 45 minutes, 20 something years ago. And it totally blew my mind. I was like, I'm going to eat everything like I just ate that raisin, right? And, you know, of course, you know, 3 hours later, I'm like eating pizza and watching Simpsons reruns in my parents' basement. And this is, you know, 1999 or something. And it's hard to maintain that formal mindful eating, but finding these ways in more subtle, smaller ways that we can begin to perhaps bring smaller informal aspects of mindfulness to eating, right? Not just eating past full and ignoring our body's signals, but learning to listen to our body. What's that moment that you become satisfied when we slow down? Right? Thinking, reflecting a bit more on, right? Not just eating and multitasking, but when we're eating, just eating. Thinking a lot, as I did during the pandemic, not just, you know, this food's appearing on my plate, but thinking, oh my gosh, these people at the grocery store are risking their lives. The people at the factories, I don't know, in the US anyway, it was like at the food factories and the meatpacking plants that they were having the outbreaks at first. But people, right, the massive interconnection that we have and connections we have with others just around food being so incredibly powerful. And eating as we eat too, thinking about what are all the cultural messages that we've received about this food. This is good. This is bad. This will make you fat. This will make you ugly. This is shameful food. This is good food. This is bad, right? All those messages, can we let go of those a little bit? When we let go of that story a little bit, we usually make more natural choices for ourselves that are more caring for our bodies. I often share, I really love this. I saw this meme online. It says, there's this guy at the coffee shop sitting at a table, not on his phone, not on a laptop, just drinking his coffee like a psychopath, right? It's like, can we just slow down and enjoy this one meal for what it is, just, you know, tasting it, enjoying it with all of our senses? That can be so powerful. So caring for our bodies, getting the sleep that we need as well, which of course is such a tall order, but we know that mindfulness practices, self-compassion practices, self-soothing practices are very powerful in allowing us to feel a sense of safety so that we can sleep. And we know this tremendous research
actually during the Gulf War, they were looking at which people were most likely to develop post-traumatic stress and which were not. They found that the truck drivers actually had the lowest levels of post-traumatic stress, and they were trying to figure that out, even if they'd been through like an IED or roadside bomb or something like that, or come under attack. And what they started to look at was the truck drivers in the Army in the US are actually required by military law to get 8.5 hours of rest every night. And they started to realize that actually getting the sleep that we need or getting the rest that we need actually really does help us to process even incredibly difficult experiences, even though at the same time, right, it's very difficult to sleep. So finding these ways to care for our bodies and getting that rest that we need, even giving our bodies rest, if not sleep, a practice I learned from an old colleague that I really like, something of a body scan and relaxation practice, just quickly moving through the body, the chest, arms, legs, and mouth, where we hold a lot of tension. With trauma in particular, doing a body scan, eyes closed, can be very challenging for people if they've experienced different traumas in their body, which is where not all, but most traumas occur. So we don't always want to close our eyes. We don't always want to go too deep. So we can do this eyes closed or eyes open. We'll keep it short. And it's really just trying to listen into what different parts of our body might be telling us. So if you like, you can close your eyes. You don't have to. This will be maybe 3 or 4 minutes at the most. And just checking in, noticing sensations in your chest. Heart beating fast or slow. Is your breath high or low? And just tensing the muscles there in your chest and releasing. A for arms, where often we're shaking a little bit, or hands sweaty and hot or cold and clammy. Noticing, are your arms communicating anything to you emotionally? Is it accurate or inaccurate about the circumstance you're in? Tensing your arms and feeling the tension, and then just releasing, letting go. L for legs, which often with anxiety, stress, trauma, or bouncing, see that a lot, and just letting your legs become still. Tensing the leg muscles and releasing. Lastly, M for mouth, where I hold tension. Some of us might also. And just squeeze, tensing. Feel the tension in your mouth, and then just release and let go. And you can bring your awareness back outward once more, maybe beyond the screen, noticing the colors or corners in the room, grounding yourself again, and back once more to the screen. I realized I'm moving a little fast. I thought I had an hour, and then realized I have just about a half an hour for the talk portion of this. So I want to make sure I allow some time for discussion and questions. Just turning a bit from mindful care for our bodies to thinking a bit about our relationships, and that this too, we know from research actually, that isolation, right, can feel like such a natural thing we want to do after difficult times for some of us, right? And yet we also know that the more isolated we are, there's these amazing, very distressing pieces of research, mostly out of the UK, about the health effects of loneliness, that it's just about as bad as smoking, if not worse, in terms of one's physical health and lifespan and longevity and medical issues and complications. And so while shame and trauma and the difficulty that many of us have experienced, right, makes us feel like we don't deserve to be a part of society, or we feel cut off from the rest, or we feel like, how to even begin to connect with others. We know actually that beginning to build relationships where we co-regulate with each other is very powerful in rebalancing our nervous system when we find healthy people who co-regulate with us, who validate us, who are able to use through their what we call mirror neurons to experience and feel what we're feeling. And we turn toward each other and we connect through compassion, and we really do heal each other. This is something many of us have experienced, but there is real research behind it, right? Not surprisingly, the power of human connection. And finding these ways to do this that we also know are very powerful in terms of happiness and thriving in the positive psychology research around things like acts of generosity, acts of kindness to ourselves, and then sharing those out into the world actually do start to really ripple out in powerful ways. So that, again, as someone who's interested in the science and interested in the spirituality aspects of this, I've often wondered, like, what's the deal with karma? Is that real? What go around come around? And actually, researchers from Emory and Yale, Nick Christiakis and James Fowler, they're actually public health researchers. They were looking at actually what they call behavioral contagions. And they found actually these amazing behavioral contagions around acts of kindness, that doing an act of kindness, actually it trickles out 3 degrees of separation. So that those things of doing something, caring for somebody else, right, or letting someone go in front of you in traffic or something like that, right? Then that person's nicer to their kids when they get home, and the kids are nicer to the dog, and, you know, all these sort of things start to ripple out. We also know that acts of kindness and generosity and compassion, they make us feel good. They actually re-regulate our serotonin. We get a boost of dopamine, so it actually becomes self-reinforcing to perform acts of kindness and generosity and compassion in the world, right? So that we get these benefits, we rewire ourselves. We also know that actually shifts our what are called our epigenetics, which is the way that our genes express themselves in ourselves and our offspring. So that actually one of the terms I've heard a lot in these past few years has also been this idea of becoming a good ancestor. Right? We think about this especially in terms of social justice, but that actually when we do the healing work for ourselves, we're changing, right? It's rippling out at least 3 degrees of separation to the kindness that impacts everybody around us through co-regulation and mirror neurons, and people act more kind, and it does eventually actually come back around to us. And it also trickles out in terms of if we do have kids or plan to someday, right, that actually we can see that their genes express themselves differently and they act less threatened in the world and they act in kinder ways in the world. So it's really amazing when we think about what is karma, right? And thinking when I first started these practices, Thich Nhat Hanh and Gandhi and the Dalai Lama, and if you want peace, right, peace begins with you. And, you know, if you want change in the world, start with yourself. And I thought, yeah, that's great. That's great for other people to start with themselves, but I'm going to go change everybody else, right? And realizing, oh, you know, not only is it very hard to change other people, right, but it is very hard to change myself. And how hard it is to change myself actually tells me how hard it will be to change other people. But in fact, if I do change myself and do that hard work, actually, that truly does impact those people close to me. It impacts those people a few degrees of separation away from me, and it impacts future generations in astonishing and powerful ways too. So simple acts of kindness, smiling to the checkout clerk, asking how their day is going and meaning it, right? Letting someone go in front of you in traffic, giving a tip next time you're at that cafe, even though it's kind of like, what, why are you asking me to tip before I've even gotten my muffin? But okay, whatever. Just, you know, being nice, these things actually do trickle out and begin to make a difference in all these ways, including to ourselves. So finding within boundaries, How can we be kind and compassionate to others? And I think that's also for all of us really nice, earnest, meditating types, right? We're often kind of givers. So we want to be careful about having good boundaries and not being doormats and that kind of thing. But the importance, though, of skillful generosity toward others really is so healing for us as well as being healing for others. But because we tend to be maybe not great at our boundaries, or maybe I'm just projecting given my own experience and not always having great boundaries. I remember in the pandemic realizing I've spent 45 days in a row, including weekends, telling other people how to do self-care. I need to stop working so much. So I struggle with this myself, but perhaps to do a bit of a self-compassion practice for ourselves for the past few minutes, then I'd love to open it up for questions because I'm sure folks have questions and comments, but let's find a nice, comfortable, mindful posture. Maybe 4 or 5 minutes. Again, if your eyes are open, just maybe cast downward, whatever's comfortable for you. The self-compassion break. And the self-compassion, mindful self-compassion work that's out there, maybe bringing to mind a recent challenge, a recent disappointment. A moment when you heard your own critical voice active. A small moment of frustration or disappointment, small mistake. And simply offering yourself before any advice or judgment, just some validation. Oh, this is hard. That sounds tough, the way we might a child or a friend. Offering those words in that tone to yourself. That sounds hard. That sounds disappointing. Sounds painful. And if you like, you can place a hand over your heart. Feeling that gentle pressure and that warmth the same way you might hug a friend. And then some normalizing words of universal humanity. We all have our days, we all make mistakes. Things are tough for all of us, nobody's perfect. You might hear that voice saying, yeah, but, and you can just ask that voice to step aside, just continuing with, we're all human, we all make mistakes. And then some words of kindness and encouragement to yourself. May you forgive yourself, may you let this go. May you learn from this. May you be stronger for this, wiser for this, even if this is small. Finding words in a tone that feels authentic to you.
And just breathing with the awareness that we are all here together. All 117 of us, at the very least, have made some mistakes, have been imperfect. And sending some forgiveness, some compassion out to the rest of the group. Us here gathered together today. Resting in the awareness too that as we send this compassion out to the group, that we are also receiving this compassion from the group, support. If you feel natural, you can just allow a smile. To your mouth. And raising your eyes. As we come back in gratitude to our community, to our family. This morning, this afternoon, or this evening, wherever you find yourself. So again, I want to thank you all for your practice. And I'll hang out for some questions. Again, I rushed through a little bit today. But it really is a treat to be here. And I do want to make sure I allow time for some questions or discussion. So all right, I see some beautiful comments here in the chat already. Someone's asking, can I ask you a question about connections between meditations and psychotherapy? As a client, I've experienced with both. Feel immediately if a meditation leader is a therapist and I just go to all those dark and painful places, where would I go with a therapist? But that's not the aim of meditation. It feels safe and okay, but it's not neither a meditation nor a therapeutic session. I wonder what you think about it. It's a wonderful question. I feel like they're wonderfully complementary. And I think that so much of what, in my own experience of, I don't know, at least 30 years of therapy and probably 20 or 25 years of meditation, from one side of the therapy, and then, you know, 20 years of therapy from the other side of the therapy room, or from both for that matter, I find that they just really complement each other. That I think beautiful, I think in many ways, the best psychotherapy is in some ways a shared meditation of insights and awareness and interpretations and wanting to create a sense of safety. A good therapist, I think, creates a sense of safety. And certainly my hope when I teach meditation is that it teaches people to find a sense of safety that they can carry home with them, that hopefully we feel safe in a real world or a virtual Dharma hall, and that hopefully we can somehow internalize that sense of safety and carry that home. I think that's true also in psychotherapy. And I think psychotherapy also it's much more relational. And I think one of the challenges of meditation, especially as it's been taught here in the Americas, in Europe, in Africa, is that it's more solitary, or if not more solitary, one of the challenges I often found was going to my local meditation center, and we all
are there because we're dying for community, and we go there and we sit together in silence and we all go home again. And there's a wonderful community that happens, of course, in sitting in silence, but there's also something wonderful that happens in direct verbal relationship as well as that nonverbal piece that I think can be really soothing and helpful in different ways. So I think I'm not answering your question, but I'm giving you a response anyway. A response, not an answer, as a friend of mine says. But yeah. And I think meditation sometimes also helps us to go to those dark places with a greater sense of safety. And I think therapy also helps us do that. So there's a lot of parallels between the two, I think. Thank you. Donna, I believe people do their best, even if it doesn't always measure up to other people's standards. It's hard for some people under stress to give up, behave thoughtfully, and just as hard for some of those that need to receive and accept help. I think this is one of the really tragic things about the way that our nervous system is wired, is that I feel like when we're under stress, it really pushes us in a few different more polarized directions, right? Toward fight and flee and deny and minimize, whether that's climate change or minimizing racism or minimizing the pandemic, or right? And sort of that denial stuff is a little bit of a flee kind of response or a fight kind of response. And I think, yet we also see amazing things about humanity in terms of generosity come through. And I think it is very hard to learn to accept help. And that's actually why I ended this particular last something of a self-compassion / compassion meditation with encouraging people to be aware of the fact that for many of us, it's like, oh yeah, sending out like love and kindness vibes to everybody else. Yeah, this feels great. And it's like, oh, they're being sent to me too. Oh, okay, that's interesting. That's kind of uncomfortable. Like, I don't need that, but like, or that feels strange. And so just that reminder, actually, to open to that, and the importance actually of being able to receive gifts is important when we don't, I mean, not that everyone's help is welcome, right? And some people are very clumsy about how they offer help or offer advice or offer loving kindness in their way. But when we can actually open to it, right, that's actually giving that person who's wanting to give and be generous. We know how good generosity is in terms of the brain, in terms of the nervous system, right? If we deny people's generosity or we minimize their compliment, it's actually robbing them of a chance to not just help us, but actually help themselves too, by giving them a chance to be generous. So I try to remember that too, that it's people sometimes are really clumsy with how they're trying to be helpful and trying to be generous, but at least when it's directed toward me, I don't tend to take it personally if they bungle it sometimes. But I know that can be difficult for some of us when we're being helped in a way that doesn't feel helpful or feels patronizing in some way. But I think when we can open to help or open to the appreciation of what's underneath the attempt at it, it gives someone else actually an incredible gift of learning how to be generous and to try to help them cultivate that maybe more skillfully, but that it's an important thing to cultivate is our own generosity. Someone's question about climate change and denial of climate change. I do think as humans, we respond to things that are threatening with, there's so many different ways we respond, right? We can respond with denial when things are too big to comprehend or too frightening. We do this with enormous things like climate change, or many humans do. We do this with small things like, you know, the folks on the street who are asking us for money and, you know, how much they sort of sink into our peripheral vision and how to stay awake to all of these things is in some ways impossible. And yet trying to stay awake to as many of them as possible so that we can act skillfully is really important. And to be thinking about the ways that we try to do our part. Like I've got little kids, you can probably hear them screaming, but I think about these things a lot with what do I want to model for my kids? Like I don't know the, I feel like it's a koan basically, like, do I give money to the homeless person or not? Like, you know, knowing, you know, how much I know about addiction and other things like that, or it's not knowing, you know, what, you know, is it going to help this person? Is it not? But I do know that if I make eye contact with them and I smile and I say, you know, I hope you have a good day, and I mean it, that giving humanity to that person, right, is not denying, right? It's demonstrating something, it's offering something that is something important and is something of value, even if I'm not sure whether giving them a dollar will be helpful to them ultimately or not helpful to them. But I think, and I think likewise with the climate, what are the things that we can each do? How do we not deny it? And yet how do we live our lives? How do we live our lives in as minimally damaging a way possible without creating more negative impacts on the environment? We might say negative karma if that's sort of our way of thinking about things. But I do think that humans tend to want to not see things. And part of liberation is waking up to all of this suffering, and it's painful. Like, you think liberation, oh, it's going to be awesome, I'm going to be enlightened. It's like, oh, actually, no, I'm seeing everything as it is. And that's really can be distressing. But when also when we see everything as it is, we can also start to see many, many more solutions at the same time, if we're able to liberate ourselves and wake ourselves up in a skillful way. It's not just let's look at all this ugliness and pain and awfulness in the world, but we can begin to open ourselves to seeing new solutions and new perspectives at the same time. But that only comes actually through managing our own stress, through managing our nervous systems, that it's not just all doom and gloom. It's, okay, there's a lot of doom and gloom here, but there's also maybe some positivity. How can I start to water those seeds of what Greta Thunberg is doing, or what the Parkland kids are doing, or what, you know, some of the other people and movements that are inspiring us are doing. But it's a very hard one. And when we're under stress, we tend to only see the negative. So we actually do need to bring a balanced perspective to things. And that's not pretending the pandemic isn't awful, that racism isn't real, that climate change isn't happening, that violence isn't happening. It's looking at also, where is it not happening, to grow, water the seeds of that, as well as to try to extinguish the seeds. I don't know where that metaphor is going, but to prune the branches of the negativity in the world, I suppose. Some wonderful questions. Thank you. Please stay in touch as well. Yep, my website, you can find me on Instagram and whatnot. Also, I'm not on TikTok, too old for that. But you can find me on some social media. And I encourage you, if meditation does tend to have some adverse reactions for you, as some people have said in direct and in public messages, you know, I think this is a place where therapy is really useful. You know, to go back to that first question, where can they complement each other, right? Stick to doing it maybe with your therapist, or right before you got therapy, or having someone close and safe by to talk to about what might come up in meditation. I think the number one way to be trauma aware in meditation is to not just force yourself too far into stuff, right? You're not trying to strain a muscle here. You want to challenge yourself out of your comfort zone, but you want to keep yourself well within your safety zone, whether it's in meditation or in anything in your life where you're trying to grow, I think is to me the most important message. And some of us struggle to know what our safety zone is. And that's when it's really helpful to have someone trustworthy to work with, either a very skilled meditation teacher who knows about this stuff, or a therapist who hopefully knows about this stuff. And not every meditation teacher does know about this stuff. And unfortunately, not every therapist does either. So wanting to be careful and ask around for who's really skillful in these areas. Thank you all again so much. Please stay in touch. It's wonderful to see some friends here too. Thank you all for showing up from around the world, from DC and Portugal and everywhere else. It's always a treat to see old friends on the screen. And I hope I'll be back. Please stay well, everybody. Thank you.